took place. And while people were marching in that rally, they were saying, whose streets, our streets. But they were also saying, whose land, native land. And I've never heard that at a protest in Toronto. The protest was about Islamophobia, but it was opened up by Indigenous people talking about how they understand also the oppression that the state has enacted on people in this land. And then, of course, Black Lives Matter Toronto being in that historic protest in front of the police station, Indigenous solidarity there was unbelievable with the Black community. And I think that that's really the change that's happening in Canada, is that different groups who are experiencing police brutality and oppression are really coming together in this country.
I have to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us on this day's broadcast from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation here in Toronto, Canada. Erica Violet Lee, Hayden King, Leroy Newbold, and Desmond Cole. That does it for the show. Tonight I'll be speaking in Toronto here at the Hart House at University of Toronto Great Hall, second floor, Saturday night at 7:30. I'll be in Troy, New York at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, then at the Free Library of Philadelphia, Monday at noon. Oh, and a huge shout out to Miguel Noguera, our audio engineer. He and Inga have just given birth to Alexander and Sophia. Welcome to the world, kids. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the May 21st performance of Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez at the First Baptist Church in Portland at 7 p.m. Lalgudi Krishnan began his musical training at age 5, and over the years he has carved a niche for himself as a top-ranking violinist. Shahid Parvez descends from 6 generations of sitarists and is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards, including the Government of India's Padma Shri. Again, that's Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez, Saturday, May 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Baptist Church, located at 909 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the United States premiere of Liza, 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 produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Join Liza Minnelli at 3 different stages of her life, often all on stage at the same time, with plenty of songs, backstories about the iconic and troubled daughter of Judy Garland, with a bit of dancing and prancing and much humor among the frightening tales of drink, drug abuse, broken legs, strokes, and hip replacements. Again, that's Liza, 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 May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, inviting the public to meet finalists for the next PCC president. Forums held May 23rd through May 27th at 4 campus locations. More online at pcc.edu/president-search. This program is also made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies, 2 evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September are on sale now, and more information is available at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Come Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have a report from the final day of the United Methodist Church World Conference being held in Portland and how the church addressed the queer inclusion issue.
A protest is planned this weekend against the annual Oregon APAC meeting.
And we hear from a senior director at Amnesty International about their report regarding refugee acceptance around the world.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 20th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. On the 10th and final day of the United Methodist Church's General Conference in Portland, a compromise on LGBTQI inclusion is holding. Queer inclusion advocates held both a silent and singing vigils. Cable reporter Theo Burke talked to several conference voices from opposite sides of the issue and got their impressions on the conference and the church's future.
Today marked the 10th and final day of the United Methodist General Conference with delegates from all over the world here at Oregon Convention Center. Today we talked to several people at the convention, and we feature three voices, asking them if they think that the compromise to create a commission to study the LGBTQI issues and to hold a special general conference in 2 years on the LGBTI inclusion issue and to keep the peace and keep the United Methodist Church together is something that they believe will work, and we asked them about the near-term future of the United Methodist Church. We first hear from two pastors who are on opposite sides of a defrocking trial for Frank Schaefer a little while ago. First, we hear from Bob Coombs, pastor of First United Methodist Church in Germantown in Philadelphia, who was the counsel for Frank Schaefer in that trial. And then we hear from Reverend Paul Stallsworth of Whiteville United Methodist Church in Whiteville, North Carolina, who was called to testify in that trial as an expert and was testifying for the church. First, Bob Coombs.
Well, I was pleased that the resolution went to the bishops and with the bishop's response. I'm not prepared to see the United Methodist Church split. And many generations United Methodist, and I feel called to the United Methodist ministry, and I always, and I have for many years, and I've been a minister for 41 years. So I was in, I became ordained just at the time that this restrictive language was put in. Wow. And those of us who are against the restrictive language, we find places and ways to live out our faith. Early on, we established what was called reconciling congregations, and a reconciling congregation is a congregation that goes through a process on its own. The denomination doesn't recognize it, but we do, and it's a way of saying to people in our communities that we're a reconciling congregation. We welcome all people here. And this year, we celebrated our 26th anniversary as a reconciling congregation. But I do believe that the action is kicking the can down the road. But if the alternative to that was voting on schism or unity at this session with this environment, it's a lot healthier to kick the can down the road because that gives us a chance to be in conversation and discernment. Discernment's an important word for me. When you're here and you're voting, you have winners and you have losers. And that's what the contention's always been about. You know, who wins, who's in the church, who loses, who's outside the church. I have to be hopeful. I don't like the word optimism. I have to be hopeful because a real witness of the church is how we live together with all of our differences. The real purpose of the church is building what Martin Luther King Jr. called the beloved community. And in that community, there's lots of differences.
And now Reverend Paul Stallsworth of Whiteville United Methodist in North Carolina.
So do you feel good about the resolution that passed narrowly on Wednesday? Do you feel like this is a good step? I've heard some folks say it's kicking the can down the road, but we need to do it. How do you feel about that development Wednesday afternoon?
I think it probably is kicking the can down the road. But, you know, that's better than dividing. That's okay. Better than winding up in schism. I have no doubt about that.
I want you to speak to, if you could, about if you think the United Methodist Church can hold together and if these new proposals provide a possible way to hold together.
It's a very good question. I believe that by the grace of God and by God's providence that our church can remain as one. The way to unity, however, is not through humanly contrived compromises, but the way to unity is through the truth and through love. It is not through give and take political compromise.
And now I'm talking with Erica West from Alexandria, Virginia, and she is a Methodist, part of the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. Conference. She is a member of the Love Your Neighbor Coalition and the Reconciling Ministries Network, the groups, the pro-LGBTQI inclusion groups here at the conference.
Erica, what has been your take on the conference so far?
It's certainly been up and down. I came into it knowing the General Conference, it's probably the most political that the church gets, and there's so many different voices from around the world with differing viewpoints, of course, and theological understandings. So I knew it wasn't going to be, you know, peachy keen. So there's been better days than others.
Did it leave you hopeful?
So initially I was pretty excited, mostly because I was really, really afraid. I think a lot of people were afraid that all of the anti-LGBT inclusion bills were going to come up for vote on the floor, and that was just probably going to be a terrible time for people who are on the other side of the table.
There were a lot of folks from both sides saying this could, at that time on Tuesday, saying this could be really explosive and divide us.
For sure. I mean, there was definitely a ton of talk of schism, and there's a lot of talk of unity now in response to that talk of schism, because this is probably a this is one issue that really does divide the church. Even though in the United States, I think it's like 61% of Methodists think the LGBTQ people should have should be fully included and at least like have a lot of support for marriage. Around the world, it's not quite the same.
Are you optimistic about the inclusion issue going forward out of the conference, or how do you feel about it?
So I think that the special commission definitely gives us a place of like what to do next, because we need to ensure that when they have the special commission, there are LGBTQ voices on that panel.
And I'm Theo Burke for the KBOO Evening News.
Oklahoma appears to be the first state to legislatively challenge the Obama administration's directives that students must be allowed to use the facilities that match the gender they identify as, even if that is different from their anatomical sex. Oklahoma lawmakers have introduced a bill that would allow students to request on religious grounds that their public schools provide a bathroom or other facility that bars transgender people. The bill was written by Senator Brian Bingaman and Speaker Jeffrey Hickman, both Republicans, in response to what it described as an emergency and a need to preserve, quote, public peace, health, and safety, unquote. The bill did not mention the Obama administration's directive specifically. The guidance letter published last Friday by the Department of Justice and the Department of Education said students must be allowed to use the facilities that match the gender they identify as, even if that is different from their anatomical sex. For districts that refuse to comply, the directive carries the potential threat of legal action or withholding of federal funds. Oklahoma lawmakers also made waves this year by passing a bill that effectively banned abortion in the state. It makes it a felony to conduct the procedure and revokes providers' medical licenses. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon vetoed that bill, despite being vocally anti-choice. She said she didn't think it would survive a constitutional challenge.
A number of local groups are planning to protest the annual statewide meeting of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC. The meeting is being held at the Middleman Jewish Community Center in Southwest Portland. For more on the event and APAC's role in Oregon, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Ned Roche of the coalition organizing the protest.
APAC stands for America Israel Public Affairs Committee, and they are, along with the NRA, the National Rifle Association, one of the two most powerful lobbies in the country. And, you know, they're the folks who pushed for war with Iran and lobbied incredibly hard against the Iran nuclear deal last summer. There are people that wanted the U.S. to bomb Syria. There are people that support everything the Israeli government does, and then some, lobbying very hard for increased funding of Israel. And financing and politicking against any elected official that goes against the Israeli party line. And what's happening on Sunday is that AIPAC here in the local area has an annual event, and generally it happens at the Middleman Community Center. So this Sunday afternoon, they have invited members of AIPAC and other, quote, dignitaries, so that's elected officials and other decision makers from around the state, to come together. It's a closed session, so reporters are not allowed in, photographers are not allowed in, and what they do is they talk AIPAC business. So we, those of us who oppose AIPAC and its policies, its practices, its influence over American politics, will be outside protesting that event on Sunday afternoon.
And do you have any idea of what which officials would be attending this?
I don't have a list of who's attending, but I can tell you that every public official is always invited. Most attend, but I can't give you a list because, that's just not public information. They don't make that available.
What's been the extent of their activity in Oregon itself? Do they have a presence at like the local level or the state level here?
Well, what's happening on Sunday is a good example of their presence. There will be hundreds of people in the audience, I imagine, and they will get a pep talk about how, you know, the lines that we've all heard, that Israel is our strategic ally in the Middle East, and we need, therefore, to support Israel, and Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And, they do a good job of denigrating and tearing apart any concept of justice for the Palestinians, for example, because it's all about how do we shore up support for, increase support for, the state of Israel.
Do you know if they engage in any particular lobbying in Salem that you know of?
You know, that I'm not sure of, but I can tell you this, that any public official at the federal level, state level, local level that comes out strongly against Israeli, let's say against the bombing of Gaza a year and a half ago that killed 2,200 people, many of them in their homes, the majority of them civilians, more than 500 of them children. If you come out and talk against that, you will be targeted. Cynthia McKinney, a congresswoman from Georgia a number of years back, 6-8 years ago, was defeated because she took a stand that was not following the party line. So that's how they work.
Do you know what local groups are involved in this protest against AIPAC?
Yeah, it's a coalition of organizations, including, and I'll probably miss a number of them, but some of the organizations include Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, Jewish Voice for Peace, Friends of Sabeel North America, Lutherans for Justice in the Holy Land, and a number of organizations that are supportive of the idea that the Palestinian struggle for justice is really one of the key and most important struggles for justice in the world today.
When is this taking place on Sunday?
We're meeting at 3:45, and we'll be done by 4:45. So it's an hour-long protest, and it should be lively, and you might see many of Oregon's dignitaries going into that closed-door session with AIPAC.
Ned Roche, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, and I've been speaking with Ned Roche, who is a member of a coalition of local groups that is protesting the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee on Sunday in southwest Portland.
A new study of the Owyhee Canyon lands stresses the area's ecological connectivity for the wildlife and plants found near the canyons. The canyon land's remoteness has helped protect it, but more protection may be needed to preserve its unique landscape. David Kesters of KBOO News in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
The Owyhee Canyonlands are the connective tissue for surrounding land in the West, according to a new study. Researchers with Conservation Science Partners compared the southeastern area of Oregon with Bureau of Land Management and other lands across the West and found the Owyhee to be one of the most biologically diverse and ecologically intact in the region. Brett Dixon, chief scientist of the report, says his team studied the area at a landscape level and found a high degree of what he calls naturalness.
This notion of landscape naturalness is basically the inverse, if you will, of the level of human impact.
The report concludes there's particularly high conservation value to the 2.5 million acres of Owyhee Canyonlands because of its overall importance to the area. The Canyonlands have so far maintained this preservation without permanent protections, although Dixon says local proposals for resource extractions could threaten it. The Owyhee Canyonlands also has one of the darkest night skies in the West because of its remoteness. Christine Albano, who also worked on the study, says the lack of development in the area is quite astonishing given its size.
It's one of the most intact landscapes that are 2.5 million acres in size, and that's even comparing it to areas like Yellowstone National Park and the Grand Canyon.
Dixon says by combining his group's study with other local research, the Owyhee's uniqueness becomes apparent.
The Owyhees have, I think, close to 24 endemic plants, so found nowhere else on the planet. And so when you couple those local scale values with the landscape ecological importance that we identified, I think it makes a really strong case for protection.
The area also contains some of the most intact sagebrush habitat for the greater sage grouse. For KBOO News, I'm David Kesters.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For Portland's weather, there is a slight chance of showers tonight with a low of 52. Tomorrow, there is a 50% chance of rain throughout the day with a high of 65 for the day and a low of 52 tomorrow night. Today in history, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed into law the original Homestead Act. The Homestead Act gave an applicant freehold title to up to 160 acres of undeveloped federal land outside the original 13 colonies.
Amnesty International's latest report about refugees shows that the world is a bit more welcoming than governments make it seem. 80% of people surveyed in the report said they would welcome refugees into their countries. Yesterday, KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad spoke with Tara Demant, Senior Director of the Identity and Discrimination Unit at Amnesty International USA.
Globally, people understand that people have the right to flee conflict and persecution, and they have the right to seek safety and live lives of dignity. Particularly here in the United States, the overwhelming majority of people surveyed said not only should refugees have the right to flee and to seek safety, but that they would welcome refugees in the United States. What we're told over and over again is that most Americans, and certainly in our political rhetoric, is that most Americans don't want refugees. And I think what this survey shows is how out of step the anti-refugee rhetoric is here to actually the American people.
How do you think that'll change political discourse in the country?
Our hope is that more and more people here in the States will speak up to their representatives and to politicians to demand that politicians and their representatives keep in line with human rights and with American commitments to human rights and dignity. What we've seen here is that Americans feel compassion and concern for refugees, and they don't want to turn their backs on people who are fleeing war and horrific violence. And so politicians and people elected in government need to get in line with that and not be so out of step.
Just this week, 27 Democratic senators sent a letter to Obama asking him to speed up the process for Syrian refugees. What have been some of the roadblocks so far, and why is it so difficult to reach this target that was initially set of 10,000 refugees before September?
The refugee intake process in the United States is incredibly arduous and incredibly detailed. It has 14 different security checkpoints. And that process means that it takes the average refugee anywhere from 18 months to 2 years to actually get in the United States from the point of their application. That's a really long time to wait for someone who's in a camp, who's living, you know, for example, in Lebanon and less than a dollar a day.
What can people do to help more refugees come to the States?
So the first thing that people can do and should do is to understand that we're not powerless in this situation, that what's happening is not inevitable. So what we'd encourage people to do is to call the representatives and demand that their representatives don't try to block refugees. There's a number of anti-refugee bills that are sitting in Congress. That first, that they make sure that the representatives know that they support refugees and they stand with those who are fleeing violence and persecution. They ask the representative not only to try and not block refugees coming in, but to push for more appropriations and more resources for refugees. The other thing that people can do is to continue to pressure the administration to reach those numbers and to make sure that they have everything that they need to make sure that refugees can come in and to increase those numbers. So the Obama administration has increased the spots for resettlement in the United States, and that's a laudable increase for 85,000 for this year in 2016 and up to 100,000 next year. We applaud that increase, but it's nowhere near enough. And it's nowhere near what the United States can and should be doing. So people should be calling the administration. They should be calling their representatives right away and asking for our country to better support refugees. The other thing, and really it's equally as important, is that people need to be talking at a local level, not only with city council members or ombuds people, but with their neighbors. And any time that they see anti-refugee rhetoric covered in a newspaper, we're asking people to write back to that newspaper, to write a letter to the editor, and to explain that they support refugees, the majority of Americans support refugees, and that we need to do more and not less for refugees. So there's a number of things that people can do. The most important thing is that people not do nothing. We're not powerless in this crisis, and we really need to make sure that every time anti-refugee rhetoric is in our local news, in a local conversation, in a national conversation, that we're speaking up against that.
Are there any country or city models that we can look at and say, hey, they're doing a great job of resettling refugees, and how can we emulate that?
The United States has set laudable goals, and I think that other countries should try to seek such goals. The Canadian government has certainly more quickly been able to bring in commitments to settle specifically Syrian refugees and to make sure that happens in a timely manner. I think the most important thing that the United States government can do on an international level is to encourage other countries for responsibility sharing, to make sure that other countries are also taking in higher numbers of refugees, particularly Syrian refugees who are in crisis, but then also with our own politicians to not try to block this type of movement moving forward, to stop putting in bills that are meant to restrict refugees, particularly bills that target Muslim refugees and are deeply discriminatory. So I think there are certainly other models in other countries that have done more things more quickly, and our own government can look to those types of governments. But ultimately, we need to not get in our own way.
Any final thoughts?
The most important thing is that people understand that each one of us here, sitting and listening to this, sitting in our homes, we all know what it's like to want to be in a safe space. And we all can think about what it means to be in peril and to do anything that you possibly can to protect your family. People who are refugees and people who are being resettled are 1% of the refugee population is even considered for resettlement. These are people who are seeking safety. They're seeking shelter. They're seeking a better life. These are all things that we understand. These are basic human things. And reaching out with compassion means doing something whenever you see anti-refugee rhetoric, whenever you hear it. So I just really encourage people to understand that, like, we can all be part of this solution because we all understand that need, that human need for safety and security.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamie Haddad.
Researchers say suicide rates in Gaza are soaring to unprecedented highs as the humanitarian situation on the ground in the impoverished and blockaded coastal territory continues to deteriorate. Abir Ayub reports from Gaza City.
Suicide was once a very rare cause of death in the very conservative society in Gaza. Yet since the second half of 2015, researchers started noticing a sharp increase in the suicide rate in the besieged enclave. Dr. Rami Abdu of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor says hunger and depression have driven young people in Gaza to commit suicide in public acts, such as setting themselves on fire or throwing themselves from tall structures.
We've documented 5 cases of people who died by committing suicide in the first 3 months of this year. These are the cases we know about, which means there are more cases we don't know about. If we compare this number with previous years, we can see there's been a spike. The number of people who committed suicide in the first quarter of this year is equal to the number of those who died by suicide in all of last year.
The same organization's figures say at least 90 others tried to kill themselves since the beginning of 2016, but survived their attempts. Experts suggest many of these cases were more cries for help than earnest attempts to die, but that they should be taken seriously. Rizq Abu Sitta is one of those who survived. The father of 7 climbed an antenna tower in downtown Gaza City in February and threatened to jump off it.
I had nothing to lose. I wanted to escape. When civil defense employees showed up, they all spoke from their own perspective, saying things like, "Come down, this is prohibited." Do they think I don't know it's prohibited? I was just leaving the mosque after the afternoon prayer. I walked for a bit. I didn't know where to go. I was feeling under so much pressure, and I climbed.
Abu Sitta, who is an employee of the Palestinian Authority, said he felt desperate about how the seemingly endless fighting between the governments of Gaza and the West Bank was blocking his salary payments and making it impossible to provide for his family. It's a familiar situation for many Palestinian civil servants in Gaza.
People have reached a point at which they can see there is no horizon, no future, no open borders, no aspirations. People graduate from schools and then stand in lines waiting for a job. The situation in Gaza gets worse every day.
The 2014 Israeli